So we're here with Diane Lee today. Hello, Diane. Thank you so much for meeting with us today to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, we've not met before, so we haven't met, and I don't know much more about you than I can find online. So I was wondering if you might be able to introduce yourselves to our listeners, just in case they aren't familiar with who you are and what you do.
Wow, okay. That's always a difficult question, defining yourself, isn't it? So I'm a physiotherapist and graduated in 1976, so a long time ago now, and I was trained in the Canadian Orthopedic Manual Therapy System. I was an instructor and chief examiner in that system for almost 20 years, and then so had a very much a manual therapy background. I worked with Cliff Fowler for a while, and who was one of the founding fathers of manual therapy in Canada, and had a very, very strong interest in helping clinicians use their hands, so be able to do things with their hands, et cetera, et cetera. And then I met in 1992 Dr. Andre Vleming, who is the chairman of the World Congress on Low Back and Pelvic Pain. And the very first edition of the Pelvic Girdle book, the little green book published in 1989, if anybody has it, archive it, landed on his desk. And it was the first book that he had read where someone was talking about linking regions of the body. And long story short, he invited me to come and present my ideas around the pelvis to the very first World Congress on Low Back and Pelvic Pain in 1982 in San Diego. And I said, well, what would you like me to talk on? And he said, well, how about the relationship between the lumbar spine and the pelvis and the hip? And I went, I can do that. That would be great. How long? And he said, 15 minutes.
Oh.
And I went, right. How's that going to work? So that started a really long journey and an ongoing one today, and a very good friendship between Andre and I. And up until Dubai, which was just in October of this last year, I've been involved and been able to present and represent the clinic shop floor, as Greg Grieve would say, be able to represent the patient, show me the patient, to an increasing audience, of multidisciplinary audience of researchers and clinicians, and it's been an amazing journey. And in 1999 is probably when Linda Joy Lee joined me in the clinic at Delta Orthopedic Physiotherapy Clinic. And she started to travel and assist me on my courses. And it was very evident at that time that this was a very bright physio that was going to be able to contribute more and more to my knowledge base. And she certainly has. And that's kind of led, there's been four editions now of the Pelvic Girdle book, and so the fourth edition, which is the integrated systems model, which I'm sure we're going to be talking about, is a model that I now teach through a series of courses, and it's a model that was co-developed with my work together, not only with LJ, but also with Andre Fleming, and from the research that's just been happening the last 30 years. So I own a clinical practice in White Rock, BC. I also travel and teach internationally on different courses. I have a very strong interest in women's health and in perinatal care and in postnatal care. I have two lovely children and two Havanese dogs. I do yoga. It's on my bucket list to learn to play the piano. And essentially, that's a little bit about me in a nutshell.
Well, that's amazing. I think you have just answered all my questions, and we can end there. No, no, I don't mean that. thank you for filling us in. That's a really interesting story. And you have covered a lot of what I was going to talk to you about today and ask you about. So I'll just go back to some of those things, and we'll revisit a lot of the things that you've just mentioned. Do you specialise in lumbopelvic hip region, or do you treat other? I mean, you're a clinician, so obviously you treat anyone that comes in the door. But do you specialise in lumbopelvic hip region?
I think most people worldwide think I do, but in fact, I have the approach that I use in assessment is a whole body approach, because it's becoming more and more clear that while I still think the pelvis is the center of the universe, The universe can be hit by meteorites that come from everywhere. And so the key is to understand whether or not the pelvis is the victim of the problem or whether the pelvis is the cause of the problem. And so to understand pelvic girdle pain really requires a thorough understanding of how the whole body integrates and connects together through not only the skeletal system, but all its various other systems as well. So I've had a long interest in the pelvic girdle, but it's certainly not my only interest.
So you do see patients who come in with other complaints?
Absolutely. Headache, shoulder pain, foot pain, plantar fasciitis, incontinence, prolapse.
Anything.
You name it. Yeah. Yes. I just treated somebody from the Cirque du Soleil yesterday.
Oh, wow.
Who had three shoulder repairs, and she had a couple of thoracic rings that weren't moving well. And so,
I do lots of different things. And so are you're a clinician and an educator. How do you split your time between your clinic and teaching?
With very efficient time management and having great support staff. So I started teaching in 1981, and my kids were born in 84 and 87. So I was a clinician and an educator before I was a mom. And it was clear to me when my kids were really young that if I was going to continue to teach and as well as manage and maintain a clinic, that I needed lots of family support. And I was very, very fortunate to have that and to have my aunt to step in whenever I needed her. And my Auntie Sheila really taught me how to take time for myself and to recognize that even though your patients may want you 13 hours a day, your family needs you for more than that as well.
And that's so important to remember yourself.
Yes, yeah. I have not seen patients more than 3 days a week since my kids were born. So Monday, Wednesday, Friday was the clinic. Tuesdays and Thursdays, I was at home. And whenever the kids were in school, that was my teaching prep time. And the weekends were off. And I've kept a fairly structured life in that way, in the sense that I now see patients from 8 till 1, 3 days a week. And from 1 till 4, I do co-consults in the clinic for my staff or for other people I want to fit in. And again, Tuesdays and Thursdays are my work days at home for writing and reading and teaching. And keeping a balance is
nice.
The thing I've lost as I've gotten older is the ability to work till 11 o'clock at night. And that's a good thing.
It is a good thing. Definitely.
So it's just about time management. That's
good. Awesome. And you still do a lot of teaching. Do you still travel to teach as well?
I do. I'm just back from a trip in March to Switzerland, Portugal, and Finland, and I've then been to Toronto for part one of my series, of course, taught in White Rock last week. I leave next week for Japan, and then I'm in New Zealand and Australia in the fall. So, but I'm building a new teaching studio here in White Rock right now. It's going to be called Akasha, which is the Sanskrit word for space, the first element of creation. And I'm hoping, because I turned 60 this summer, that some of the international trips will slow down a bit and that people will still be interested enough in becoming an effective and efficient clinician to come and join me in White Rock. So the travel is not going to stop, but I think the number of places I go to in a year will certainly get less.
Oh, that's excellent. It's interesting. It's nice that you're teaching, you're creating a teaching space in your clinic. That's really nice to have, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Then I can use my teaching team. I have some wonderful associates here that help me and travel with me within Canada, and Rachel, Kathy, and Tamara, and Nicole. And so to be able to have the team with you, that it's just going to be very special. I'm looking forward to it a lot.
So a lot of what you teach is, talk to me about the integrated systems model. Is this a lot of what you teach now? As I understand it from the reading I've done, the integrated systems model is something that you've developed, and correct me if I'm wrong, but is it a method to organise knowledge and skills for clinical reasoning and to develop clinical expertise? Would that be...
That would be spot on. Yeah. And in brief, we call it the closet organizer. Now, it started years and years ago. It probably started in the early 80s when in Canada we were introduced to the American osteopathic approach, and our work sort of switched from seeking pain generators and trying to treat pain to trying to treat the cause of the pain. So at that time, you know, we were looking at foot biomechanics and how it affected the pelvis. I and Jan Locock were really into looking at the thorax and how thorax problems could affect the pelvis, etc., etc. We just didn't have the same language around it that we have now. And of course, we don't have the same, we didn't have the same level of detail of clinical expertise and understanding about it. So when I was writing the fourth edition of the Pelvic Girdle book, I was thinking about what do we call, what do we do? And I remember LJ and I sitting on a plane and kind of going, what are we going to call this method? And it took us forever to come up with the name because, of course, Andre and I had a model, have a model around the pelvis called the integrated model of function, which speaks to form closure, force closure, motor control, and emotions. And that's a model that can be applied to different regions of the body, but it evolved from the pelvis. And the integrated systems model is a bit different than that in that it looks at relationships between regions and how, not within the region, which is what form, force, closure, motor control would be, but how the regions are behaving and influencing each other. So we settled on the term the integrated systems model. Integration, from as defined by Dan Siegel, means the linkage of differentiated systems into a functional whole, but we didn't know that until after we picked the word integrated. And then the language kind of evolved from our writing together, and which was the beauty of working with LJ in that time, was sort of really, we really, really held each other accountable to our language and what we were going to call things. But the principles and the concepts of this model, there's people all over the world that are looking at the impact of corrections on function. Lynn Watson, for example, in Melbourne, part of her PhD is on looking at the impact of changing the position of the scapula on shoulder strength. Greg Johnson's the Institute of Physical Art, when the foot hits the ground, looking at the influence of the foot on an ascending chain of all sorts of different biomechanics that can happen. So I do teach courses principally now on this model, and the series goes from head to toe. The course, there's two courses that I take on the road, and one is on understanding the relationship between the thorax and the pelvis, because we can't just teach the pelvis as an isolated entity anymore. And the second one is a very similar course, but it's one that's biased towards women's health. I've been doing a lot of research in the last 7 years together with Professor Paul Hodges, looking at the impact of diastasis rectus abdominis on force closure of the abdominal wall and the pelvis. And so there's a course that I've developed that is specific to myofascial deficits of the abdominal wall, and who can we train and treat to get better with physiotherapy, and who should we be referring for a surgical repair. So those are the two main courses that I take on the road with me. And then for the full shebang from head to toe, it's come see me in White Rock at the series. Yeah.
And so the series is about it being from head to toe. So do you divide the integrated systems model into the different sections that you sort of talk about?
So the model is applied to the whole body. So we start off by applying it from the third thoracic ring to the hips. So we look at the relationships between the hips and the pelvis, the low back and the pelvis, the thorax and the pelvis, and try to find what we call the driver or the primary cause of the problem, where best to intervene. And that's where the clinical reasoning comes into it.
About the primary driver, how would you define the primary driver? That's the primary cause of the dysfunction.
Yeah, so we try, and it's a driver is what LJ and I decided in terms of calling something a driver is a region of a body. So it may not be what's causing the problem in the first place, but it's the region of the body that if you intervene here, you're going to get the biggest bang for your buck in terms of changing alignment and performance elsewhere. So should you go after the thorax before the pelvis? And within the thorax, should you go after the third ring, the eighth ring? Which one within the thorax is more primary? Or is this really the old whiplash that has caused a bunch of stuff happening at the craniovertebral joints that are causing compensations in the thorax and therefore causing compensations in the pelvis? Where do you go? So there's a series of very simple tests. We look at timing of when things go wrong in something we call a meaningful task. And we look at the impact of corrections of one part of the body, so correcting alignment, biomechanics, or control, and the impact that that has on two things, a person's ability to perform the task and also their experience when performing the task. If you correct someone's alignment or control and they feel worse, then continuing to do that is not going to make them feel any better. So both the patient's experience, their proprioception, their interoception of how they're feeling with what you're doing has to be positive, as well as the change in alignment, biomechanics, and control. The tests that we pick to assess are not dictated by the region of pain in your body. So, for example, if someone comes in with low back pain, we don't necessarily look at them doing forward and backward bending, because if their problem is they get back pain with running, people don't bend forward and backwards when they run. So we're going to look at a step forward task, we'll look at thoracic rotation, we'll look at being able to advance the body over the foot to be able to pronate and supinate the foot. So we look at the task they're having problems with, which is meaningful to them, and say which key assessments do we then need to analyze to determine what's going wrong. Someone who has exactly the same pain location in their back or their pelvis when they sit, well, we wouldn't look at a step forward task, because you don't step forward when you sit, you do a squat. So we really pick the task that has meaning to the story, and then figure out what's going wrong in ultimately the whole body to find this thing, the driver. But I can't teach all that in 5 days.
No.
So you have to do it in chunks. So the first part is from third ring to the hip. The second part is going from third ring up to C2. So we go up into the neck, but not the cranium. And then we have a whole day on part two where we teach orthopedic physiotherapists to palpate the external pelvic floor. Because all orthopedic therapists say, that's not my area, I'm not going near it, I'm not going to spend money to have an ultrasound machine, and I'm not going near those holes. So this year, I had two pelvic floor therapists join me to teach the orthopedic therapists exactly how do you palpate ischiocavernosis and assess that it's working? How do you palpate transverse perineal muscle, assess that it's working? Because it's the stability muscles for the pubic symphysis.
Yeah.
And we had a great day. So that's part two. And then in part three, we layer on the knee and the foot and the cranium. And perhaps part four, if I ever get it developed, we'll then go into looking at more relationships to the arm and the rest of it.
So, well, I hope you do get it developed.
Yeah.
A lot of what the listening to you talk and the way you talk, your approach is very centered around the client or the patient. And I think and the way you're talking about assessing for the primary driver, it seems like a really high level of clinical reasoning and clinical expertise, in that you're breaking down their function and where their pain is in function, as opposed to just their simple pain. And I think it just seems like it's a method for really high level clinical reasoning as well.
It is, and I've had both new grad therapists and therapists who have a lot of shoes in their closet, so they've been out for a long, long time, take the course, and both struggle. Because if your closet is too muddled and you have too many things in them, and it's tough to know what to remove, what to keep, and where to go on. If you have no shoes in your closet, or one pair, one shirt, one pair of pants, there's nothing to organize yet. There isn't enough clinical experience where anything I say resonates for you. So that if I can remember being in the same situation in my first 2 to 3 years working with Cliff, where he would say, he'd read an article and he'd say, gee, I just don't see this person in my clinical practice this article's talking about. Do you? And I'd go, I don't know what the heck I see. I just try to get through patient to patient. What is it? There was no pattern recognition, right?
Yeah.
So you need to kind of have some experience before this course is really helpful, but you don't need much. 2 or 3 years, and then it gives you a good framework or a structure. This is not a classification system. It is a framework to help clinicians organize their knowledge. When do I pull out my manual therapy skills and assess the articular system?
Yeah.
When do I go to motor control? When do I pull the pain neuroscience and start talking about cognitive beliefs and emotional beliefs and all the pain neuroscience? And when do I when do I need my physician friend to get on board to start talking about testosterone levels in middle-aged women who still want to run high-level marathons, but their estrogen and testosterone levels are dropping and they're not making good muscle mass, so they're tearing their muscles all the time. Like, how do I know what part of my team is best to see and what tool in my toolbox is best to use? So that, I think, is where the beauty of being in practice over 35 years comes into things, because you have lots of patterns that you recognize. And the other things that I really, really want to pass on to clinicians is the gift that I received from Cliff, and is how to trust your hands. Because the human hand can feel things that science yet can't measure. And Annelies Poole-Gutzwart and I tried to see if the MRI could actually measure the sacroiliac joint mobility test I proposed in 1992, and we couldn't do it. There's still is yet to be developed a measuring tool for these fine movements of the thoracic rings and the pelvic ring to be able to pick up what we can feel. And yet that doesn't mean that we should stop feeling these things or because we can't validate them, and we shouldn't stop teaching them. So I teach lots of things around why I think the intertestinal reliability studies in the pelvis have shown us to be, not that great. I think some of us have better kinesthetic skills, others have better visual skills. And I think that we can teach clinicians to use their hands. I know we can teach clinicians to use their hands in a more reliable way, and to use them as sensors and not only as things that do things to people, but to land on someone and just listen to the nervous system through your hands, and you get lots of information that way about where you're going
to
go.
It's so nice to hear you talking about people using their hands like this. I know in places... there is a discussion around about people not using their hands and hands-off approach to treatment. And I know, in some countries it's, advocated in practice due to cost effectiveness, all that sort of thing. And so it's so nice to hear you talking and really advocating for the use of using hands and placing hands on, and just talking about, validating, although it's not validated by evidence or anything, that we can feel things, we feel things through our hands. And I think as well, we are experts at feeling things through our hands. And the more experienced you are as a clinician, the more your hands feel. And I think that probably makes a difference to that evidence base as well. And the sort of experience that we have as a profession in developing that, the use of hands. I think that's, it's just really nice to hear you talk about that.
So what is evidence? So there's no science. There may be limited science, but there is tons of evidence. Because if you look at what evidence from Sackett's definition is, there's three component parts to it: patient-centered values and goals, the research evidence, and clinical expertise. So we have tons of clinical evidence that you may not be able to quantify or put numbers to yet. And I think there's we have lots of evidence. We just can't publish the evidence that we have yet.
Yeah.
The other point that I would make is that I think sometimes the more trained you are as a clinician in a method, the harder it is for people to feel their hands. Because I can take little kids, and when my daughter was really young, before she was a yoga therapist, she could feel things and still can feel things with her hands that just blew me away, because she was never told that she couldn't. So when clinicians are told, you can't feel a sacroiliac joint move in active movement, Andre tells the world that what we're feeling is an illusion. And he said to me just before I presented at IFOMT, he sent me a text and he said, sweetie, don't elude and delude the world anymore. You cannot feel the SI joint move in an active weight and an active test. We have this agreement to not talk about it for a while. Because I go, of course we can feel it if we can feel the movement. And Chelsea could feel movement. She was a little girl and still can now, because no one's told her that she can't. And so we're energetic bodies and beings vibrating at certain frequencies. And if we tune into those frequencies, we can feel them and we can pick it up. And I think quantum physics clearly supports that as a vibrating multi-molecule sort of individual, you can resonate with other energetic beings on a level that isn't about Newtonian physics measuring mass, matter, movement. It's a bit bigger than that.
Yeah.
So think there's evidence, and I would hate to see our profession not teaching manual skills anymore, because there will be another profession that will step in and take our place.
Oh, well.
And it's already happening.
Yeah.
It's already happening.
Yeah, it is. It's part of what we do. What we do is use our hands, and yeah, and we need to keep that.
There's two parts, I think. We use our hands, yeah, for sure, and we also assess and treat movement.
I was just going to say that.
Always being about helping people. We've never been, well, that's not true either. Most of physiotherapy hasn't been about saving lives. It hasn't been about life or death. It's been about improving the quality of someone's life and perhaps extending life by keeping people moving. You know, moving for life is our PABC motto, our Physiotherapy Association here in BC. And whether it's cellular movement through electrotherapy, whether it's actual physical mechanical movement through ultrasonography, ultrasound, thermal stuff through our hands, or through training movement through exercise, through posture, through Pilates, through yoga, through whatever happens to be your background and your love, that using our manual skills, our movement skills, and our education skills. Every physiotherapist is an educator. Empowering people to understand and to take responsibility for their own health is a huge role that we play. We can talk to people and we can touch them at the same time. And that's pretty profound to be able to have that, the privilege to be able to do that with people and take them on a journey.
Yeah, it's really... I've thought about movement, and there's a big discussion in the profession at the moment about us being about physiotherapy or physical therapy and the movement system, about relating our profession to the movement system. And it's really interesting to hear, because when I've thought about movement, obviously, and I suspect that other people think about movement as movement of the system, of the muscles, of the skeleton. And I haven't actually thought about how you just mentioned movement of at cellular level, movement at a cellular level, and how we create that movement using our hands, using electrotherapy. And it's interesting, and I was just about to say before you started talking about movement, you're clearly an advocate for manual therapy, but I know that you're an advocate for movement as well, because I saw on your website that it says... on your website, the banner at the top, it says empower through knowledge, movement and awareness. And I really, really like that.
Yeah, there's two actually. Empower through knowledge, movement and awareness is sort of etched in the glass in the clinic.
Oh, is that?
And in the new space, because I'm moving the clinic this year, it will be engage, experience and empower. So you can't empower somebody with knowledge or movement unless they choose to be empowered, until they're ready. And how do you help somebody be ready? You have to engage them, first of all. You have to help explain or have a good hypothesis of what the problem is. So you have to explain your findings and what you think is going on and engage them in that kind of understanding so that they can experience the differences in their systems and in their body doing things one way versus another. So it may be something as simple as just changing how your pelvis is on the chair, getting your pelvis in, underneath you instead of tucked forward, and just sending them home with a tiny little thing to do. For example, I had a fellow this morning who was a bit resistant to going somewhere that he didn't feel that his problem was at. And so you leave him with a small thing to try, you know? So all I want you to do is engage your pelvic floor when you get out of the car and see what happens to your sacroiliac joint pain. And because when he engaged his pelvic floor, he could control the movement of the joint. And when he didn't, he kept pulling on the ligaments. And as soon as he engaged his motor control system, his pain went away. But he didn't see the relationship between his motor control system. He thought his SI joint was out. Please manipulate it. And I was not going anywhere near that, right?
Yeah.
You need to be able to control this joint movement. So that would be the only treatment. Because until I get the buy-in from this fellow, until I can engage him enough to experience something different, I can't empower him to be able to train his brain to use his pelvic floor the way he needs to stop stretching his ligaments and to stop going to people and having it manipulated, because it gives him that endorphin effect or release effect or whatever it does. It makes it feel better for a few weeks, right? So empowering people through the knowledge of what's going on, helping them move better, to be aware of things, requires engaging them in a conversation, having them experience something different, and then putting the responsibility back on them to do what they need to do to be better. Yeah.
So what was that? Engage, experience, and?
Power.
Empower. It was empower. I was just writing that down. Yeah, that's really nice. And yeah, it is important that we engage our patients that way, our clients. And it just, when you talk about it, it makes total sense. And it's really clear the importance of engagement, the importance of educating our clients or our patients about their conditions and changing their experiences so that they can use their new knowledge that you're providing them with to, I suppose, help themselves as well.
So what it's all about, isn't it?
Yeah.
People coming back, and you know, people would say to me, you know, we didn't have any of this knowledge around transversus and the pelvic floor years and years ago, and yet my patients get better. And in fact, one of the students on the series this year had said to me, you know, I never found any drivers before I came to this course, and my back pain patients got better. So why are you saying that this is what I have to do? And I said, I never said that. I said that it's what you can do. My goal is to make you a more efficient, effective clinician.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that you're not going to get people better any other way. Of course you are. And I think that what we've always done has, but probably not done as well as we could have, has been to educate patients. And probably some of that was because we just didn't have time in the past. You know, we used to work on 15-minute appointment blocks. And there's no way you can engage, experience, empower someone in a whole person, whole body approach in 15 minutes. You just can't do that. You definitely need more time. And so I think it's really important that clinicians are also taught a bit of business sense when they have the controls, that they know how to organize and manage their day, time management again, to be able to deliver the best services possible. And you know, the whole idea of getting patients to fill in sheets and sheets and sheets of information so that you don't have to spend as much time in your subjective exam seems wrong to me. So too does electronic medical records, in the sense that I've obviously been looking at it because we're moving the clinic. But I've seen so many clinicians spend more time relating to their computer, trying to get the information into the computer. And then you lose that relationship that you're developing with the patient. So it totally changes the context of the session. So I'm not so sure about that, you know. And then as I say that, I have a new clinician working with me now who is just a computer iPad whiz bang. And I mean, he could probably type on this thing and engage with somebody else and not have it interrupt their relationship development at all. But for me, I need eye contact. I need to be in their space. I need to really feel their presence. And I think they need to feel me present as well where we're going.
That's a really important part of assessment that doesn't get talked about as much, talked about either, about the patient connection. It doesn't get talked about in relation to how we are moving towards working with computers and recording everything on the computer, showing our exercises on the computer. It is becoming very computer-based. And that is, you know, that is the way to move forward. It is going to go that way. There's nothing we can do about it. But we do lose, you're really right, it's really interesting to hear you talk about it, how we lose that connection with the patient when we're doing that. And I wonder how that's going to affect just our assessments and our connection with the public and our reputation and things like that as well.
I think if we're cognizant of it, that it won't. Yeah. But if we have computer monitors in the treatment room and you have your back to the patient and you're just turning your head every once in a while going, oh, sorry, I didn't get that. Can you repeat it again? And not being really conscious of the fact that the person sitting in the room is more important than you getting it down on paper at that moment in time, then it can be all good, right? So it's fantastic to be able to draw on the resources that are online and to be able to print things off and have them right at hand on your computer. And I love having my computer in my office with me when I'm having my appointment with the patient. But when it comes time to actually being in the treatment room and actually having a dialogue and doing an objective assessment, the computer is nowhere near me. And when we were doing the DRA research, and I was being very strict about the things that I was gathering, and I had to have the computer with me as I was gathering it, it really did interrupt with the flow of the relationship. And I found myself interrupting the data collection to stop and go, okay, how are you doing with all this information we're finding? Can I help you answer any questions? And do you understand what this is meaning? Because I do not want to have somebody catastrophize about anything that we're saying. I don't want them to make it bigger than it is. So I think if you're aware of it and you have the time that you can manage it, it's very doable.
Yeah, but I think you're right. Just about awareness. So being aware that whilst you're filling in your 10 forms that you have to fill in for each patient, and I know some people have to fill in a lot more than others in different countries around the world, that you mustn't forget that relationship with the patient, because that relationship is all about going back to the engagement and the experience and the empowering the patient. And so it's important in that respect as well.
It is. And I mean, you can have, and I mean, Mark Jones and Darren Rivett in their clinical reasoning book state this beautifully when they say, given the same painful impairment, no two patients will have the same experience, because how they manifest their pain and they manifest their experience is directly driven by the context of the situation, by who they are, what they think, what they feel. So all our past memories and all our past experiences are going to influence it, regardless of, you may find a fourth ring shift to the left, an unlocking your side joint, and a leaky bladder in one woman, and you may be totally treating them totally different, because the driver may be their cognitive belief in one sense, and another person the driver may be the pelvis, and in a third one it may be the fourth ring. So
and without
clinical reasoning, you are lost. There never will be. People are often asking me, what is the exercise program for DRA, for the diastasis? How do we close the gap?
Yeah.
And I won't let the cat out of the bag, and the fact that we don't want to close the gap, but I've already let the cat out of the bag. But there isn't one, because there are so many different subsets of reasons why a woman has a separated abdominal wall, and treating them, again, is highly individual.
Yeah.
There can never be one exercise program for it. There is a goal to be able to generate force closure across the abdominal wall is the key thing. Whether or not that comes with the narrowing of the interrecti distance is irrelevant. It's about being able to generate tension, which fits in beautifully with the 1990s research of Andre Fleming. So it's, it's good.
And so this is where, this is all about clinical reasoning, and it's like not, I guess it's just about clinical reasoning, and it's where your integrated systems model comes in, and teaching people to use the knowledge that they already have, organizing that knowledge, using their skills, putting it into clinical reasoning, becoming more of an expert so that they can manage their patients as individuals and put that patient or that client at the center of their own treatment or management program.
Yes, and it's also about putting the fun back in physiotherapy, because there's something we call the wow effect. You know, when you do a correction, whether it's on a foot or a cranium or a clavicle or wherever it is, and it makes somebody's arm elevate or their head turn freely with no pain, they'll often go, wow, what did you do?
Yeah.
Or maybe you wow yourself and you go, how does that work? And you make up a big story because you haven't a clue. And you just go, I don't know, but it's pretty cool, isn't it? Because there will never be an RCT that will explain the patient who comes with an ankle sprain at the age of 14, a whiplash when they were 18, two babies in their early 20s, and four abdominal surgeries. Where do you go? Like, how do you look to the evidence, or what clinical guidelines will there ever be for, you know, our complex, complicated patients? So this is where I don't want your listeners to think that we don't look to the research. Of course we do. The reference list for the series is over 55 pages long, and that doesn't even cover the whole body.
Mm.
So we look at the evidence. I follow it a lot. There's key researchers I follow, and we integrate it. We knowledge translate it.
Yeah.
And we're constantly looking for the new studies. We test them, we try them in the clinic, and those ones that change our practice, we use. For example, Henry Sow's studies on creating a new brain map for transversus was practice changing for LJ and I, in that it was three sets of 10, 30 repetitions changed the brain map. And I used to just get people doing five or six reps. I'd confirm it on the ultrasound, and I'd say, yep, you got it, go away and practice lots. But I never knew how much. And they would often come back and they, I'm not sure if I've got it. I'm not sure if I'm doing your little exercises right or not. And sure enough, they wouldn't have been. So when you sit and you have somebody actually do 33 sets of 10, 10 second holds with a 2 minute rest in between, it's like watching paint dry. It is so boring. But they've got it. And very few people come back and go, oh, I'm not sure if I've got it anymore. So the MAST practice and the principles of neuroplasticity that I use all the time in the exercise programs. So building new brain maps, new synaptic pathways, snagging, as Dan Siegel says, snagging the brain to stimulate neuronal activation and growth that was practice changing for me. Some research I read doesn't change my practice, but then every once in a while you get those little gold pearls that you kind of go, ah, oh, this really makes a difference. And we integrate it in. And again, every once in a while your own closet needs a cleaning. And you ask yourself, you know, why do I have pink stilettos? I'm never going to wear them anymore. Like, I do not need that technique.
Your analogies are amazing.
You know, so like, let's just get rid of those shoes and replace them with something that works a little bit better. So
let's get back to one of those golden nuggets. And I know it's not research, but we haven't talked much about your book yet. And I wanted to talk to you about your book because we're using your book this month in our member area. We're doing a lumbopelvic assessment month. So we're talking a lot about the lumbopelvic region. So your book is called The Pelvic Girdle, but it's much more than The Pelvic Girdle, isn't it? There's lots. So, and when I say much more, if I simplify that into how I look at the book, and there's a lot in there about lumbopelvic hip complex, you talk about a lot in the book, and also your integrated systems model and the clinical reasoning approach that you have developed as well. So it's more than just The Pelvic Girdle, isn't it, your book?
Yes, and the title was chosen, remember, in 1984.
Of course, yes, of course.
Yeah, so it was published in 89, but the invitation to write it came much earlier than that. And so it's about branding, isn't it? You sort of keep the title of a book. The subtitle of each edition has changed.
Okay.
So that's what has evolved and changed. And so the subtitle of the fourth edition is An Integration of Clinical Expertise and Research. And the book is essentially divided into two parts. And a lot of it is much bigger online. Hey, so there is over 680 pages online with the book as well.
Is there more text online? Text content?
Yes.
Okay. I didn't realize that. I know there's a lot of videos and lots of case studies.
And a fabulous chapter that Andre and I wrote, which is an interview between the two of us. We've written it in an interview style of our journeys in the 90s together. And it's about the collaboration of a researcher and a clinician and how that all worked. It's a lovely story to read online. That's chapter one, the historical and contemporary perspectives on the pelvis, because it's been both of our passions for a number of years. And then the next few chapters are sort of updates from the previous editions with more current information brought forward. So chapter four, for example, has more of the current evidence on the sort of the motor control in terms of the function of the lumbopelvic hip complex. And chapter six is a brand new chapter in this edition looking at pregnancy and sort of integrating prolapse and incontinence with pelvic girdle pain and some of the studies that have been done around that. A little bit on the DRA, but not a lot because it wasn't really consolidated in my mind at that time. And so the model, the integrated systems model, really starts in chapter 7 with a chapter that LJ and I co-wrote on the model, and that's the chapter we reference for the most part when referring to it. Chapter 9 is fantastic, and it's mainly online, and it is 9 clinical cases of all sorts of different things with video clips, and you can Elsevier has now really done a nice job with the website. Initially it was tough, you had to go from different pages on the site, but now you can just click on the mouse click as we had originally planned, and up pops a beautiful video that demonstrates exactly what the test is. So you can see hands moving, and it just is a probably more modern way of learning.
A real compliment to the book, isn't it? A real compliment to the book to have the videos available when you're talking about techniques in a book.
Absolutely. And there's a great movement chapter, chapter 12 that LJ wrote that sort of brings in a little bit more of what we've been doing on the thorax as well. But there really isn't a lot on the thorax in here other than through the cases, because the book is titled Pelvic Girdle.
Yeah.
So through the cases, you see the role of the pelvis or the role of the thorax on the pelvis. But it really is a focus on the tools and skills that you need for being able to assess and treat lumbar pelvic hip. There's ultrasound clips in here as well, and with some interpretations for using ultrasound in the area. Ultrasound imaging, not thermal ultrasound. So yeah, it's a pretty big book.
It is. It's a big book, and there's an awful lot of things in there, and it really is an amazing book. There's so much work has gone into that book, and we had one of our volunteers independently reviewed the book recently, and she said to anyone who is mystified by the, don't quote me on this, this is similar to what she said, to anyone who is mystified by the pelvic girdle, the pelvic region, the sacroiliac joints, this book is the one for you. So she, yeah, definitely felt that it was a great complement to, or a great addition to her knowledge, to be able to have that book and read it as well, to demystify the sacroiliac joints, the pelvis, and that region.
Well, I do really have to offer my thanks and gratitude to Elsevier, Churchill Livingston, for the invitation way back when to do this. This book has opened so many doors for me internationally that just wouldn't have been possible. I never would have met Dr. Andre Vleming if it hadn't been for this book. And just to have a forum to share the clinical voice. It's not a book that's based, it's a book that is evidence-based in the sense that I try to bring in the research as best I can. It's getting harder and harder because there's so much of it.
Yeah.
But it really has shaped my career in the sense that when you said, you know, you're known as a pelvic girdle expert, and that's probably true worldwide, but it's certainly not what my patients think of me as when they come in. Mm. I've always sort of treated the whole body, but I think without Elsevier's support and without this book, my career would have looked a whole lot different. So thank you for that opportunity.
Well, on behalf of everyone who's going to listen to this and that we're going to share this with, thank you so much for sharing your career with us in a book. It is a really great book, reference book to have. And so thank you on behalf of everybody.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed chatting with you today, Rachel. Thanks.
Yeah, well, thank you. So I guess, can I just finish with one quick question? One quick piece of advice. I know you're pushed for time, and I know you're off to see another patient, and we thank you for your time today, but one quick piece of advice for our listeners in relation to their clinical practice that you might be able to give everybody.
And this piece of advice has come from mentors of mine from years and years ago. For every question you ask and every assessment test you do, ask yourself, why? What is the purpose of doing this? What's the question? What information am I hoping to gain from this? And if you find a test result that doesn't match your hypothesis, to take time to step back and think about what else could possibly be going on. And this is, as Gregory Grebe calls it, clinical reasoning on the shop floor, thinking on the fly. Learn how to think on the fly.
That I think that's a really valuable piece of advice. So thank you. Thank you so much for spending the time today in between patients to speak with us. We really, really do appreciate it. We'll be posting this audio interview on PhysioSpot, and we'll add all the links to your websites and the book and things as well. So thank you for your time today. Is there anything else you'd like us to add?
Not at all. Just my thanks.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.